Today is August 28th, 2013, and this is episode number 219 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin. They say there's no devil, Jim, but there is. Right out of hell, I saw it. Matt, where's your crew? On the third planet. There is no third planet. Don't you think I know that? There was, but not anymore. They called me, they begged me for help, 400 of them. I couldn't. Get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
Okay, we have two things we have to address here. I know, only two. The first is, I need to find out if we actually can get business cards big enough to hold your titles. And the second is, we really need to work on adjusting your meds.
That may be the case. We tried to raise Starfleet. No one heard. No one!
You really do an awesome Matt Decker.
I do. Yeah, I don't do my Shatner is pretty terrible, but my Matt Decker is okay.
The great thing about your Matt Decker is you have to be sitting in a chair to do that, and the way you grab the arms of your chair and push yourself back like you're trying to get away from the doomsday machine, the pain in your face, it's really like watching the episode.
It's true. It's on the one hand, he went to he was like the star pupil at the William Shatner School of Overacting. Right? Yeah. He graduated with flying colors, reset the bar. What is the actor's name? Is it William Wyndham?
Yes.
William Wyndham. But, you know, and I used to, like, when I was a kid, I sort of mocked that. It was one of those things that was, you know, an example of everything that was wrong with Star Trek or something. But at some point as an adult, I came to appreciate the genius performance. I mean, his performance, especially throughout the rest of the episode. Like when he's taking over the Enterprise and he's, you know, and he's having...
And he's just very cold and calculating.
Yeah. Oh, it's just... Just a great performance. It's the Doomsday Machine episode that we're talking about, and definitely one of my favorites.
It's an awesome, awesome episode. Have you seen the remastered version with the new special effects?
Oh yeah,
that so enhances the episode.
Let's stick a link to the Blu-ray versions of the remastered Star Trek stuff in the show notes. Because, I love those things. I can just watch them over and over again. And I promise that's my last Star Trek-related title for at least a few weeks.
Brian's a liar.
No, for a few weeks, I promise.
Okay.
I promise.
And it's up to our listeners to keep track of that, because I certainly won't.
All right, well... This is the Apple Context Machine, right? This is the one where we talk about Apple stuff.
Oh man, I keep thinking we're doing the sci-fi show.
what are we going to do? What are we going to do first today?
Well, let's see. We've worked through the Doomsday Machine.
You know where that's got to go. It's got to go right to Steve Ballmer.
Yeah.
So last Friday, he announced his retirement within the year.
Right.
And this was, our last show was obviously last Wednesday.
Because Steve doesn't bother to coordinate with us.
No. And he should.
No, he should just be gone. He can't coordinate with us. He should be out.
Well, he should be out anyway. He should be out anyway. Did you see that, that excellent piece over at Stratechery? From the guy who was saying if Steve Ballmer ran Apple. Did you read that?
No, I didn't. Please tell me about it.
Yeah, let me get the guy's name. Stratechery.
All right, while you keep looking that up, I'll fill everyone in real quick. Steve Ballmer announced on Friday that he's stepping down, that he's retiring from Microsoft, and that the transition will be finished within 12 months, and... And while he makes it sound like he decided it was time to do this, it kind of feels like maybe some other people helped him decide it was time to do this.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, there have been rumblings that have been surfacing throughout the internet that the board helped him decide to come to that decision.
Well, let's get to the stuff about the board and timing in a bit. So, first of all, this piece is by Ben Thompson, who's at Monk Bent, M-O-N-K-B-E-N-T, on Twitter. But he blogs at strategery.com, which is S-T-R-A-T-E-C-H-E-R-Y.com. We'll have a link in the show notes. Right here, I'll just give that to you right now because, you know, that's how I roll.
Awesome.
So he put together a very, very excellent piece of analysis on what would happen if Steve Ballmer ran Apple. And he talks about how Steve would go after the entry-level market with a cheaper iPhone in China. How he would double or even triple the number of carriers that have iPhone deals like Samsung so that they could maximize their exposure around the world. He makes all these bullet points of all these things that Steve Ballmer would do that would instantaneously increase profits at Apple. Increase sales and profits at Apple. And there are all these things that a lot of people have called on Apple to do, and he lays out this great case of exactly how Microsoft would do it, and the point that he comes to is, and in the process would make sure that Apple never again innovated, never again disrupted. Talked about doubling, massively expanding the sales force and putting in all sorts of incentives to hit new sales goals, about reaching out to the enterprise and making sure that Apple's operating systems and products were all very, very enterprise friendly, and again incentivizing the sales forces to make sure that happened. And again, it's a great piece, and he makes a great point. Steve Ballmer would do all those things, and in the process would destroy innovation. Because, you know, what happened under Steve Ballmer, the reason why Steve Ballmer kept his job so long, despite clearly having no vision, is he massively increased revenues and profits. Massively.
That's true, he did.
And shareholders, well, I would say shareholders like that, but that's probably not the case because his stock is essentially flat, which in real dollar terms means it's lower than when he took over, despite the massive increase in revenue and profits.
That's true. Microsoft's stock hasn't really grown much over the past few years.
Since he took over.
Yeah.
And that's probably because it's so, you know, what Steve Ballmer did at Microsoft was thoroughly entrench and protect and extend the Windows hegemony, and actually the Windows and Office hegemony. That's what he did. And the problem is that has kept Microsoft from doing anything interesting since, to wit, Courier. Courier was a threat to Windows, so it went away.
Yeah, which is unfortunate because Courier should have happened.
Right. And Courier was Microsoft's completely in the, I don't know what you'd call it, envisioning stage, because those were all like Flash mock-ups.
Right. Yeah, so it was a whole concept idea for a tablet device. Or tablet-like device.
Yeah, you opened it up like a book. So it was like a journal, like a notebook. And, you know, two different panes, but they were connected. But you could do different things in both of them. And the way you interfaced with it was unlike iPhone and iPad, unlike Windows 8, and unlike Android. You know, it was definitely a completely different approach for doing stuff. It was really interesting. I don't know that I would have used it, but it was interesting.
It would have been very tempting. It's a device that, had it come out, I would have sought one out. so that I could really see what it does.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, they the way they were showing it, they had people using it effectively like you would use an incredibly capable notebook. You know, where you like you just put your ideas in and, you know, rearrange things and develop ideas, develop concepts. It was just really interesting. But it got canned because it threatened Windows.
Yes, and there's the whole thing at Microsoft about there's all that infighting between divisions and it's very competitive in an unhealthy way.
Yeah, there's a lot of turf wars.
Yes, turf wars, that's true. And that environment it fosters a system where what you already have is what you will continue to have.
Yeah.
So change is not something that's pushed at Microsoft.
No, it's not. In fact, I mean, if we look at Windows Phone and we look at Surface in particular, we see what happens when you try to design a tablet for the purpose of protecting and extending the value of Windows, of the desktop metaphor. We see what happens with that. And it's a piece of crap that no one wants. It's a piece of crap. No one wants it. And they've cut the price. They've slashed the price on it. And no one wants it.
Yeah. They're going to start dumping them on whoever they can. And still no one will want them.
Still no one will want them. You know, I don't think anyone's actually put out a tablet that anyone wants.
Well, Steve would know now, wouldn't he?
Yeah. That guy, I tell you, man, that guy. All right, so the question that I have, the question that we talked about when we were prepping today's show, what can Microsoft actually do? What can Steve's successor do?
He needs, or she needs, to come in and look at the company not from the perspective of or not from Steve Ballmer's perspective. They need to look at the company with new eyes, and they need to make some very potentially scary decisions for the company about what's working and what isn't.
Well, that's just it, though. They don't need to make scary decisions. They need to make the right decisions, and the right decisions shouldn't be scary.
Well, the right decisions can be scary at times, because the right decision doesn't always mean that the business is going to move in the direction you think it will. So in that sense, those right decisions can be scary. Another thing that the new leader will have to do is look at this whole system of fighting between divisions and figure out a way to put an end to that. Because if you have companies or if you have divisions in your company that feel like they need to sabotage other divisions so that their products don't get killed or lost, you are ruining yourself.
Yeah, well that's a cultural thing. And that is solved by no longer worshiping at the altar of the deadline. And developing and embracing a culture that worships at the altar of the product, and that's something that Microsoft has never had. Now, we've talked about it on the show, right? When I talked about my discussion with Steve Capps on this?
I believe so, but it's been a while.
So Steve Capps is one of the original Macintosh guys. He was an Apple stud. He was a Newton champion. And he's the one that ended up taking over the Newton project and helping to bring it to market, for good or for ill. And it was a big deal. He became an Apple fellow. And then it was a big deal because Microsoft hired him. He left Apple to go to Microsoft in the 90s. This is before Steve Jobs came back. So early 90s. And his job, what he was hired at Microsoft to do was to help make their products suck less. That's my verbiage.
And that's a really good explanation. And my guess is someone inside Microsoft said that at one point as well.
Probably, yeah. It wouldn't surprise me if they actually told him that. But they were definitely wanting to bring some of that quality to Microsoft. And what he told me, this was at the Apple Lore reunion that was about 10 years ago here in Silicon Valley. He said, Brian, I can tell you what's wrong with Microsoft. And he said the difference, or he said, I can tell you the difference between Apple and Microsoft, I think is how he put it. But he said that at Apple, you worship at the altar of the product. So it's the product that matters. And there are lots of people empowered to say no. And at Apple, according to him, this was before he left, and I think this is probably the case today. At Apple, if two people were working on the same thing, and one of them saw that the other person's approach was better, he would stop what he was doing and go work with the other person because they're all working on making a great product. And again, lots of people were empowered to say no. And products didn't ship until they were ready. That sort of thing, right? That's something I think that remained even while, or at least mostly while Steve Jobs was gone. Mm-hmm. And he said if you go to Microsoft, they worship at the product, at the altar of the deadline. Everyone's bonus is predicated on meeting deadlines, meeting goals, and no one has the big picture. Everyone is in charge of little tiny fiefdoms. Everyone's in charge of their little thing, and they have to meet their goal. And so there's all these people working on their goal, and then at some point it gets mashed up into a product somewhere. And no one has the power to say no. And if you did say no, you would mess up a whole bunch of people's bonuses, and everyone would freak out. Now, again, this is going back. I don't know if this is exactly how Microsoft functions today, but I think that it seems right to me that at the very least, the spirit behind these issues is still the case at both companies. And he said the result is that a lot of products get shipped when they're not only a product of communal design of design by committee, but they're shipped when they're not ready, and no one's making anything for themselves. You know, they're all just working on their little deadlines. That has to change. And changing that would change the thing that you were talking about the infighting and the turf wars.
Yeah, and that's a huge problem for Microsoft. Microsoft has a lot of really talented people working there.
Very smart, very talented people.
And they're in what I'd consider to be a pretty hostile work environment, just overall, because they have to be watching their back all the time. Because the people working in the other divisions and working on the other projects are looking for ways to make sure that their project gets to move forward.
You know, I have a friend who used to be pretty high up in the gaming world there at Microsoft, and he never talked about that. I mean, that could be because his group was kind of special.
Well, the gaming part, especially the Xbox part, they get to run pretty much autonomously.
Yeah, this is more Windows.
Well, okay, so maybe that kind of bled over between the gaming and the Xbox teams.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, it's hard to know, but it definitely seems to be the case within the rest of Microsoft. But when I was talking about making the right choices, what I'm talking about is starting with the fact that it's okay for Windows to go. Do what Apple does. Be willing to cannibalize it yourself before someone else does, because that's what's happening to Windows right now. That is what's happening to Microsoft. Other people, Google and Apple in particular, are eating up Microsoft's legacy businesses because Microsoft has been more worried about protecting those legacies than in finding the next legacy.
Yes. And they have been so worried about that they've lost sight of the long-term vision.
Yeah.
Well, there isn't a long-term vision, really. Not for the products. For the company's bottom line, there is, which is grow market share, increase profits.
Yes, but don't do anything that threatens either.
Right.
And that's what they have to change. And if they can change that, And my assumption is that it'll require most of the executives going. Sorry, guys and girls. It's gonna mean a lot of people go away, and not because there's a problem with. I mean, like, again, there's some really talented people. Microsoft's executives are you know, top notch folks, but the culture's got to change tremendously, and Microsoft has got to be willing to find the next thing and stop worrying about the old thing. And if they can do that, Microsoft could become a, once again, could become a power, a very forceful power in the technology world.
You know, Microsoft wants to become a devices and services company.
Well, Ballmer wanted
much like Apple.
Ballmer wanted that to happen. No, there's no. We don't know if that's what the board wants, and we certainly don't know what the next CEO is going to want.
Right. Okay. So where we are right now, Ballmer is calling for Microsoft to become the products. Mm-hmm. Or devices mm-hmm. and services company, mm-hmm. and has been making steps towards that goal. So it will be interesting to see what happens when they have new leadership in place. And the fact that they're giving him the 12-month phase-out period tells me that Microsoft still is the lumbering giant that it has been for a long time. Microsoft can't be nimble. That they could be at some point, I suppose, but right now they're not. And so they've got this ball moving forward with this transition into a new company. They're now moving forward with finding a new CEO. Realistically, I think we're looking at 12 months before that transition is done. So we have a whole year of moving forward with the Steve Ballmer plan, regardless of whether or not the board likes the idea. And regardless of how it's progressing, that's the path they're on now for at least another year.
Right. It is possible that they'll find someone in 3 months, and Steve will exit quicker. But
it's possible, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't think it'll happen either. I don't. Yeah. It's, you know, it's so interesting. I mean, you know, Bill. I think Bill Gates has got some tough decisions to make. For one thing, it's pretty interesting to me that. Bill didn't ask him to stay. I'd always wondered about that. I think you and I had conversations where I said, you know, so at some point has Steve Ballmer gone up to Bill and said, you know, I think it's about time I quit. And, you know, Bill Gates responded with,
yeah, no, I think I want you to stay.
And I it's like, would that happen? Would Bill Gates ask him to stay? Or, you know, has Bill just been it's hard for me to fathom why Bill Gates has allowed Steve to stay in this position for as long as he has. I don't know if it's misguided loyalty. I don't know if he actually thinks that Steve has been doing a good job. I think if that's the case, he would have asked him to stay. So all of that is interesting, but it is certainly, you know, for the sake of, like, my personal edification, fantastic to know, thanks to Bloomberg, that Steve did not ask him to stay. I'm sorry, Bill did not ask him to stay.
Yeah, I have a feeling that a lot of what's been happening at Microsoft has kind of been off on the sidelines for Bill Gates, because I really feel like when he decided to pull back from the company, it's because his focus was no longer Microsoft. It was really his philanthropic.
Yeah, it's actually making the world a better place.
Yeah. And being tied down by responsibilities at Microsoft would be a big hindrance to his vision. So I imagine that on some level, the fact that he's had to come back in to help the company out through this transition right now.
Well, he's been chairman the whole time, though.
I know, but he is actively involved in the hiring process for a new CEO. as opposed to just being one of the guys that, that they say, hey, Bill, here's the three guys that are three people that we have found. I'm using guys generically, right. just so you guys know. You know, presenting him with three names and saying, what do you think of these three people? He's actively involved in the entire process. And I have a feeling that he felt that was necessary, that he had to take a more active role, at least for a little while, in what's happening at Microsoft. And that means he's not out making the world a better place through vaccines or hunger management, whatever.
Right. So, yeah. And I would like him to get back. I think his work with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is far more important than anything he's ever done with Microsoft.
I agree. I think that history will remember Bill Gates for his philanthropic work. And
Microsoft will be the footnote.
Yeah.
The asterisk.
Yeah, it'll be, oh, and he also did that one company.
Yeah, he was able to do it because of – he was able to do all this other really cool stuff because of Microsoft.
Right.
So, yeah. I don't know. Taking over Microsoft, you know, my fear for the sake of competition, my fear that is that Microsoft is going to hire someone that can, you know, see, you know, take Windows into the middle of the 21st century, or, you know, they need to hire someone who is willing to scrap Windows.
They need to hire someone that goes way outside their comfort zone.
Yes. Yes, they do. And I don't know. I don't know if they have the courage to do that.
I hope they do.
I hope they do too.
I'm not confident.
I would like to see. I would love to see a three-way fight. A real three-way fight between Microsoft, Apple, and Google. We would benefit as consumers.
We would benefit. I don't think that's going to happen.
At least
not for a few years.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
I think you're
and
right.
When it does happen, it will be a very difficult fight for Microsoft, because basically they'll be trying to horn in on Apple and Google's game.
Yeah, unless they can actually yeah, wouldn't it just be, you know, Apple is the company that turned smartphones into a thing. And Apple is the company that turned the App Store into a thing. And Apple is the company that turned tablets into a thing. It would just be fantastic if Microsoft ended up bringing out some new product category that no one saw coming. And, you know, and just sort of turned technology on its head. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think that it can happen. But it sure would be nifty if it did.
It would be cool. If Microsoft was able to move really fast, the earliest I could see something like that happening, and it would be really fast, it would be like 5 years from now. Because we have this year of hunting for the not bomber, and then that person has to start fixing things. And fixing things in a company the size of Microsoft, especially when so many of the problems are entrenched so deep, that's not something you can do quickly.
Mm-mm.
And then to try and create big game-changing products on top of that, that's a lot
of work.
Yeah,
but, you know, look at – and there's so many institutional differences that I know this is a terrible – comparison, but iPod was concept to release 9 months.
Apple is nimble. Microsoft is not.
No, that's what it says. There's institutional differences.
Yeah. I mean, with the blueprints laid out in front of them, Microsoft.
Jeepers Christy, the cops.
Huh?
Jeepers Christy, the cops.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. Look at the Zune. Mm-hmm. That's where I was going. I just love when you say Jeepers Christy. With the Zune, Microsoft had the whole blueprint laid out in front of them for exactly how to make a successful portable media player, because Apple had done everything. All they had to do was copy it, and they still couldn't get it.
No, and one of the reasons why they couldn't get it is because they were interested in extending their own legacy, the Windows media format. That was part of the problem with that. You know, it's just
right.
Microsoft is perpetually chasing other companies. Someone else starts doing something and makes it into a thing, and then Microsoft has got to have a little piece of it. And that chasing is just emblematic of their problems. I mean, they have to.
Well, if you're chasing, you're not innovating.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And it's pretty clear that they're not innovating.
Right. It is pretty clear. All right. Let's move on to rapid fire.
Oh, right. We have some rapid fire topics today.
We do. Go. Apple preps iPhone trade-in program.
Oh, okay. Yes. The iPhone trade-in program. Very quickly, what Apple is doing, they've already started testing in some stores in the United States. You can walk in with your old iPhone, say, I want a new one. They look at the one you have and say, we'll give you $200 for it or whatever. And then you get $200 off a new iPhone.
This is essentially the business that Gazelle pioneered.
Yes, yes. And in this case, since Apple has the iPhone that you just traded in, it can go back into their stockpile, it gets refurbished, and now they can turn around and sell it at a discount in emerging markets.
Right, through the refurb program.
Right, here in the States. And you have your brand new iPhone, and you got a discount on it, and you didn't have to wait for a box from Gazelle and a check to show up.
Right. This is sort of it sucks to be Gazelle, because the problem with Gazelle's business model is that there are no problems with Gazelle's business model. And that means that the barrier to entry is relatively low. You just got to have the interest in doing it. And Apple, of course, I'm surprised it didn't happen earlier. Apple, it's like Groupon. You know, Groupon should have taken the $4 or $6 billion, whatever it is they were offered by Google, because the barrier to entry there is no barrier to entry. Anyone can do what Groupon does as long as they have the will and a little bit of money to do it.
Right.
And I imagine that Apple is going to have a lot of success with this trade-in program, and I believe that it's going to put the hurt on Gazelle and Gazelle's smaller competitors.
I agree.
Oh, that's it.
And oh, that one caught me off guard. Yep. Okay. Next one. What do we have next? The gold iPhone 5S prototype.
Yes.
Getting all scratched up and stabbed.
Kind of similar to the iPhone 5C scratch test that we talked about last week.
Yes, in this case we have the back from an iPhone 5S, the gold back, and they take looks like quarters, and they just rub the crap out of the case with the edge of the coin, bang on the case, and it holds up really well. When they take a knife to it, like a real knife, and they stab at it, of course, it gouges into the metal, and you can see that, and they scrape the material, and yes, that shows, but it holds up surprisingly well.
Holds up better than the Slate 5 that he was comparing it to.
Yes, yes.
And the interesting thing about this is that
that timer's going. Come up with something quick.
No, I'm actually getting confused about our next topic. So that was my problem.
Oh, well, maybe we can smash them together.
Maybe.
Because they do kind of fit.
They do. Why do we even separate those? I'm so confused. This is terrible. Let's make sure that our readers don't hear what idiots we are.
They never do.
Excellent. I'll cut it out. So there are too many hands in Apple's supply chain. Apple is never going to have a secret product ever again. Ever. Never. Ever. Unless it's a software product.
Not unless they can find a really amazing way to do a new product in complete isolation.
No, we've seen complete iPhone 5Ss. We've seen these gold ones. This guy has got a prototype gold back that he's playing with. We've seen the 5Cs literally by the hundreds. We've seen 5Cs. Yeah. We've seen pictures of them stacked up all over the place. We've seen them in boxes. We've seen like little docking box things. We've seen, there are enough of these things out there that people are like banging on them with pointy objects just to see what happens.
Or even putting them up for sale. Or
putting them up for sale on eBay. And there are at least a million sets of hands going into the production of Apple's biggest products in the months leading up to the release, because they have to ramp up production so far in advance in order to have enough unit volume to sell these things, to meet demand when they hit. And we're talking about not only talking about the hands that are finally assembling them. We're talking about the tens of thousands of hands making the backs, the tens of thousands of hands that are making the displays, the cases. I mean, the cases and the displays. I mean, there are just so many hands going
in. And clearly, these people aren't seeing the threat of Apple coming down on them as a big problem.
No, because there's too many of them.
Right. And now that the iPhone 5C back that ended up on eBay, that was over $13,000 the bidding was up to before it was pulled?
$13,600. It was pulled sometime after that. I don't know if it's because Apple sent a C&D to eBay, or if the guy got really freaked out about the notion of someone paying $13,000 for what is back, and, you know, and him getting that money and being, you know, Who knows why it got pulled?
But it's gone.
It's gone. And he said he had multiple ones. And this guy, my take on this, and I have no evidence to back this up, but my take is that this was a guy here in the States who had prototypes out of Cupertino. His English was certainly excellent, and he did stress that they were prototypes and not finished products. Anyway, I had a feeling these were definitely leaking out of Apple somewhere.
That seems very likely, and considering the number of photos and samples that are getting out anyhow, totally plausible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, too many hands. No more secrets.
Yeah, it's a new world for Apple.
All right, time's up.
I heard the ding that time.
No. All right, so we have our third topic,
and
second topic,
and I feel the stress just bleeding away from me, because, you know, in the rapid fire part, it's like we have a time limit.
I know.
And yeah. So anyhow, Samsung is trying to beat Apple into the wearable technology market.
Well, which is funny because Samsung beat Apple 10 years ago. They released their first smartphone and no one bought it. You know why?
Right.
Because it was a piece of crap.
Right. Well, they didn't have anyone good to copy.
You know, Samsung's success in the Android market is predicated on two things. The first, they were able to successfully copy Apple with seemingly no ramifications. They might end up paying $1 billion, but, you know, that's just the cost of doing business. And it's possible that we're looking at an end game in the patent wars where Apple is going to actually get some injunctions, maybe, and, you know, maybe that'll stop some of the copying, but the damage is largely done. Samsung successfully copied Apple. They made their Android devices Apple-like enough to be able to sell them. So that's the first thing. The second thing is they have an enormous supply chain. They're very good at manufacturing. They own all kinds of pieces in their own supply chain. They own manufacturing, assembly. They own displays. They own processors. They own case making. I mean, you know, they're a huge part of the South Korean economy, and they mm-hmm. can outproduce HTC. They can outproduce Motorola. They can outproduce these all of these other Android competitors, and they've done a great job at it.
But when it comes to creating an innovative product, not always as good a track record.
Well, name something that has been innovative.
Yeah.
Exactly, right? And we've talked about this on the show before. I wrote the piece talking about Samsung's delusions of relevance, software relevance. And mm-hmm. Samsung fancies itself innovative. Samsung seems to think that by making their early Android phones look like the iPhone, that is somehow proof of their ability to create. And I personally reject that and scoff at the notion. And they have since, you know, with the release of the Galaxy S4, the TouchWiz interface is just freaking awful, man. It is awful.
The name is kind of not good either.
That's fine. I won't hold that against them too much. We didn't like the name iPod and iPad first either.
Right, there is that.
But we came to like it, and we still don't like the TouchWiz thing. But I mean, it's just, you know, the things that Samsung brought to market with the GS4 just don't matter. They don't matter. No one cares about them. You know, the answering your phone with a wave. It is a nifty and cool GWiz feature, but no one cares. No one cares. No one.
You know, one of the big selling points I hear for Samsung's phones is, they're like an iPhone, but they don't cost as much.
Really?
That's not.
You hear people saying
that's
that?
Not. Huh?
You hear people saying that?
I've heard a few people say that, and really, when you look at prices, you're paying the same. So there's that, which is not a good long term selling point, and the other not good long term selling point I hear is, it's not an iPhone. I don't want to buy an Apple product.
Yeah, because that business can go to anyone.
Right.
That business is not pro Samsung. That's just anti Apple. And there are going to be people like that, and that's fine. You know, whatever makes your boat float is, you know, whatever. That's fine. But it's not. And you know, and they've done a great job with bringing large screen devices to market. And there are people who want those large screens, and that's fine also, but I don't really consider it innovative. It's certainly meeting a demand. Actually, to give them credit, they identified that demand. Yeah, this is something they can get credit for. They identified that demand and met that demand.
Yes, they did.
But it's something that other companies can copy and have. HTC's got its large screen devices. Haven't had a huge success with them. Motorola hasn't had a lot of success with their large screen devices either. But I don't know. So we've got this Galaxy Gear product. They're going to
the smartwatch they're releasing.
When are they doing that event?
September 4th. So a few days before Apple's September 10th iPhone event, they're going to release this new smartwatch, and they're already setting the expectation for the quality of the device by calling it a concept product or concept device.
Well, and that's because, of course, they don't know yet what to copy.
Right, and the images of what this watch looks like, I felt like I was looking at something from the 1980s. Really?
Fair enough. They're not. The only thing I like about them is the deployment clasp. which is what high end watches have as the deployment class, but you know, that makes sure that it stays on your wrist. It's a nifty little thing. If they're bringing a deployment class to a product inexpensively, that is mildly interesting to the watch enthusiast in me.
Actually, you know, you know how often I wear watches. Mm-hmm. For those of you playing at home, the answer to that is practically never. Mm-hmm. And I have one of the Lunatic watch setups for an iPod Nano, and it has that deployment clasp thing on it. That's actually a really cool feature.
Yeah, the deployment clasps are nice. And it looks like that's what the thing has. But, you know, this whole, like, underselling it as a concept device, I don't even know what that means.
I think they're hedging their bets there so that if it doesn't sell well, or if people look at it and go, man, this feels half-baked, they've already set the expectation that it's a concept device. And they can say, look, we told you. But if people really love it, then they can turn around and say, hey, you know, You know how much you love this now. Imagine how great it's going to be when it's no longer a concept device.
Right. And I think definitely somewhere in this, I don't have any evidence. I'm not claiming to know this, but I think that it's true. They think that by getting this thing on the market before Apple does its so-called iWatch, which at this point, we're expecting sometime in 2014. You know, Apple hasn't announced it, but again, there are no secrets anymore.
Right.
That by getting this thing on the market before Apple, that we will somehow be fooled into not thinking that they're still copying Apple, even though they don't know what to copy yet. And I don't think the world is that stupid. Well, I don't know. There are lots of people who say that Apple that Samsung is innovative and Apple isn't. So maybe the world is that stupid.
Well, we are living in a world where Apple presented a strong case to show that they weren't colluding to price fix in the ebook market, and yet they ended up losing their case in court.
Yeah.
So,
but I mean, God, even the most diehard Apple sucks, Android is awesome fan has got to understand that Samsung is doing this because Apple is rumored to be doing this.
You would think, but we're dealing with technology on an emotional level, which is kind of a weird thing, mm-hmm. but
it's true, though.
It's the way
it's why we have a show.
It's why we have a show. That's right. So we're looking at this from an emotional standpoint, just people in general. And when you throw that into the mix, it becomes much easier for people that prefer Samsung products and are Samsung fans to then say, look, Apple is just following Samsung's lead. This is proof that Apple can't innovate and that Samsung can, because Samsung released their smartwatch before Apple.
Yeah, and there will definitely be some Apple haters that say that. It's just, I don't know, man. It's just so obvious. And here is my, this is not even a bold prediction. Here's my just outright prediction. This Galaxy Gear is going to flop. It's going to suck. It's not going to be interesting. No one's going to buy it after the first few weeks. And it is going to be dramatically reshaped to copy the iPhone, or excuse me, to copy Apple's iWatch once Apple actually does announce the said product.
Yeah. I have a feeling you are totally spot on. I am, however, intrigued by Samsung's watch, simply because I'm really curious what it is that they think they've come up with that's so great.
Right. And yeah, it's going to be nothing. It's not going to be an interesting product. You know what? If they really thought it was nifty, they wouldn't have spilled so many beans about it and released pictures before they even announce it.
I agree. And when I look at this thing, I just keep thinking this is the 1980s future version idea of what the Casio data bank would be. I mean, really, that's what it looks like to me.
I wonder if they're going to do some more sketches for us, more skits. Say, mister, what's that on your wrist? It sure looks interesting. Well, son, that's my new Galaxy Gear from Samsung. Pum, pum, pum.
Yet, see, this is why I need podcasting juice more than when I'm podcasting, because what was Samsung thinking with that whole skit thing that they did? And because that was for the Galaxy S4, yep. Right? And yeah. Which shows you what an impact it made on me. I don't remember which product it was for. I just remember how disturbing the presentation was.
Yes. And you know, I hadn't thought about this, Jeff. So I've been going on about this delusions of software relevance for a while now. Mm-hmm. So it turned out that what we saw was not really what was planned or envisioned by the creators. And what we saw was a product of Samsung executives in Korea micromanaging the skits and making changes to the skits. Making changes to the skits that were written by Western Broadway folks, performed by Western Broadway folks.
Yes, all professionals in the theater industry.
Aimed at a Western market. It would be, to me, that would be like Tim Cook trying to micromanage
the Russian ballet,
or some kind of made for China extensive marketing campaign. You know, at some point you need to listen to the people who are actually experts in the thing that you say that you want to actually do.
Right. There's a reason you pay a lot of money to experts.
Yeah, and it's like they have all kinds of delusions over at Samsung. They have all kinds. They think that they are all that in a bag of chips, and they are not. And at some point, that is going to come back and not haunt them, but bite them in the butt.
Yeah. Well, that whole Galaxy S4 launch event. Well, geez, people are still talking about it, but they're not talking about the phone. They're talking about how bad the presentation was.
Yep. And the phone hasn't even sold that well.
Yeah, well, there you go. So I can only imagine what type of introduction we'll get for the Galaxy Gear. And this is being done at an event in Berlin. So,
oh, good Lord. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I'm seeing some kind of cross between... You know, I'm seeing like, I mean, you know, there were the misogyny. There were some very misogynistic aspects of the GS4 launch event.
Yeah, to the point that I was offended.
And I could see, you know, they say if you start comparing things to Hitler, you've lost the argument. But I could just see some inadvertent jokes tapping Germany's heritage. That don't go over well. Like, see, either that or like some kind of weird cross between SNL's Dieter, Mike Myers' Dieter character, which I love those sketches too. All right, let's just head this off.
I'm thinking we've hit the point where if we go farther,
yes,
we could potentially Samsung our show.
Genius, sir. Well played. Well played. I salute you. I bow at your feet. That is genius.
That's nice. That is brilliant. Thank you.
Samsung. We wouldn't want to do that.
Every now and then I get a good one.
Yeah, that's great. Oh, man, it's good. Wish I'd said that. Can I edit it so that I say it?
You can, sure.
Well, I mean, yeah, literally I can. I won't, though. But so funny. You're listening back to it. Hey, wait a minute.
What the?
Why you? All right.
So for all of our listeners, when you're doing when you're writing your reviews at the iTunes store about how much you love us, and thank you for doing that. If you catch a point where Brian has edited out me so that he can say something, go ahead and let
They'll
it go.
Never know.
Yeah,
never know. Yeah, but do please write us some reviews. If you do, we will read them here on the show, assuming we like them. That's the caveat.
Well, it is our show.
It is our show, right? All right, so let's head out.
Okie doke. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. Thanks for listening. Feel free to follow me on Twitter and app.net. I'm Jay Gamet at both places.
And I am TM O'Brien on Twitter. It's Brian with a Y, and I'm Brian Chaffin on app.net. My blog is at geektells.com. Yours, by the way, is Fresh Brew Tales.
It is.
Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for us, and that's all for this week.
And I forgot to tell all our listeners, my Ignite Denver presentation was selected September 18th at the Paramount Theater. Show up. 1,300 seats. It's going to be awesome. So there's room for you.
It's fantastic. We'll have a link to that, too. Do we have a link to that?
Of course. Excellent. We do.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.
We love you.
Yes.